Hello, this is Valerie Jackson in Conversation, where I get to talk with some of today's most dynamic artists, innovative thinkers, and interesting personalities. Sports, some people can't live with them, and some can't live without them. Actually, there are some sociologists who believe that sports have replaced formal religion as a dominant force in the lives of many Americans. Sports often reflect our values as well as reinforce gender stereotypes. My guests today, Mary Brock and Laisha Clarendon, can certainly speak to this. Mary Brock is co-owner of WNBA Atlanta Dream, the only all-female ownership group in Atlanta professional sports. Mary and her husband, John Brock, are truly one of the most generous power couples in Atlanta. They have funded and endowed chairs at Georgia Tech and Emory University for cancer research and for John and Mary Brock football facility. Mary now serves on the board of advisors for the Winship Cancer Institute and a member of the trustees of Spelman College. In addition to the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra, she also supports the recording artist Usher's New Look Foundation. I am delighted to have Mary with us today, but even just as delighted to have Dream member Laisha Clarendon. Laisha played point guard for the Indiana Fever for three seasons before coming to Atlanta as number 23, which happens to be my favorite number. She completed her college career at the University of California, Berkeley in 2013, receiving national recognition. And she was named to the women's team, which represented the USA in 2009 at the U19 World Championship in Bangkok, Thailand, helping the USA team to an 8-1 record and the gold medal. She's an outspoken advocate also for LGBTQ rights and was named 2015 OutSports Female Hero of the Year. I've been truly looking forward to this conversation. Thank you both for joining me today.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Yes.
Good, 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 good. First, Mary, I want to thank you and your husband, John Brock, Chairman and CEO, Coca-Cola European Partners, for all that you do for Atlanta. You are truly one of our most generous benefactors. But so tell me, though, you and John kind of grew up together, as a matter of fact. I think I even read somewhere that you may have had a little premonition in the seventh grade about him. Tell me about that.
That is absolutely true. How on earth did you find out about that? But yes, John and I did grow up in a small town in Mississippi right on the Gulf Coast, Moss Point. I moved there in the fifth grade. He's second generation, Moss Point, Mississippi. And in the seventh grade, I was writing in my diary, we were in the same church. Like, you know, all small towns have three or four churches. We were in the same one. And I wrote in my diary that he was such a nice boy that I thought he would be a good husband one day.
Unbelievable.
He has that as a PowerPoint presentation now. And when things get too boring and people are stopping, you know, their attention span or not paying attention, he throws it up there as good decision making, thinking ahead. You know, I mean, I always say he was a slow learner because we didn't even start dating until he was a senior and I was a junior. Of course, the next week I might have named something else.
Did you play sports as in your
youth?
You
know, one thing that Kelly Leffler and I say,
Kelly is your co-owner,
and Kelly is the co-owner with me. What we always say is we're, you know, a generation apart. And it's a big generation because I was pre-Title IX and she was post-Title IX. So I didn't have the opportunity to play organized sports, and then she did play basketball through high school. Interestingly, though, my mother, you know, a generation ahead of me, did play, played half court. You know, that was when it was all half court. And she was from this little town, Junction City, Arkansas, which is right on the Arkansas-Louisiana line. And they won the Arkansas State Championship. And her first time out of her state was to go to a championship. But they wore the short shorts, half court. You know, they thought women couldn't do anything else. She was quite the athlete. So I like to think that had I been, you know, I think I would have been a point guard at 5'6".
All right.
Exactly.
Why do you feel it's having a basketball league for women is so important?
Well, my interests have been, as I have grown up, education, clearly. I'm a teacher by training, master's in curriculum development, and that's very important to me. As you said, I'm on the board of Spelman College. Young women are very important to me. I have a daughter. I have multiple nieces and nephews. I'm the oldest of six children. My mother's the youngest of 12. I have 26 first cousins. I can't tell you how important I think equal opportunities for young girls are. And I'm also obviously a child of the South, where you wake up on Saturday morning and figure out who won all the high school games.
Right.
And then you wake up on Sunday morning and you know who won all the college games. So I grew up loving sports, even though I couldn't participate. So clearly it's important to me.
And you're very involved in the whole nexus of sports and leadership and the correlation between those two. As a matter of fact, you're working on several projects that make sure that comes to fruition. Is there anything in particular? I know that there's a Women's Sports Leadership Project. Are you involved in any way in that, talking about C-level females and how they have access to boardrooms and C-suites are those upper titles like Chief Operating Officer, Chief Executive Officer, Chief Information Officer, whatever. So the C-suites.
Yeah, there have been so many studies and surveys done about successful women, whatever you determine success to be. And let's just say you take business, like you were at that point. If you look at women who are successful in business, and let's just say success is being in the C-suite, and you survey them and find out if they participated in sports at any time in their lives, over 80% participated in sports.
Amazing.
And it might be in elementary, middle school, high school. Maybe you're good enough to go on to college. But it's so important to participate in sports at some point in your life, to learn how to fail and get up and bring yourself up and try it again. To know that if you are good at anything, and certainly if you're good at sports, it doesn't come easily. You work so hard. I mean, our team works so hard. I mean, you know, you mentioned Usher. Musicians work so hard. They've got to be in good shape. They've got to work on their skill set, which is their voice. Whatever you do in life is hard work and intensity, and sports is absolutely no exception. We just think this is good for young women who are growing up to know that they can do something.
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, the International Women's Forum, of which I'm a member, has a relationship now with, I think it's Ernst & Young, Women Athletes Business Network, and they're taking former elite athletes and pairing them with business women, outstanding business women, so that those business women can show them how they can transfer those team skills and those sports skills over into business.
Right.
Outstanding.
Because they certainly do translate, for sure. And you know, one thing that we know about our team members, and Lesia is a very smart young woman, I don't doubt that she'll be successful after basketball, but most of your adult life is going to come after basketball. So, you know, you work hard at your sport and your skill, but, you know, you might be 30, 32, 35, and then you're going to move on to something else.
Right.
So we think that's part of our responsibility for these incredibly talented young women.
I agree that this is so vital, so important that we have leagues, women's leagues, who can lift women up like that. But talk about the viability of the WNBA, because there are a lot of naysayers out there who said it's not going to work, even though it's been 20 years, 21, 21 years. You know, there's, oh, it'll never work. And granted, it's tough. We've had two soccer teams to fail here in Atlanta. So what is your assessment of the state of the WNBA?
Well, that's a very good question, and we have a relatively new, she's in her second season, a leader of the WNBA. We're very proud of the fact that she's from Atlanta, Georgia.
Val.
Well, actually, she was certainly very key, but I'm talking about Lisa Borders, who's now.
My friend Lisa.
So
yes.
Lisa is president of the WNBA. She is clearly the person singularly who headed up the group of women. They call themselves the Group of Five, I believe, who brought the Atlanta Dream to Atlanta. She got to know everybody at the league, and she can look you in the eye and say, this is going to happen. We are going to have a team in Atlanta, Georgia. So she was clearly our number one fan, and we believe, even though she has to be neutral now, that she must sit on her hands when she's at our games. But clearly leadership is important in the league, and good leadership. Adam Silver is, you know, the commissioner of the NBA. They own our league. They don't support our league. So a lot of people don't understand that. They think we're successful because we're supported or underwritten by the NBA. They own our league. We have support from the league through league sponsorships, just like all the other professional sports. If Anheuser-Busch is a sponsor of the NFL, that's going to trickle down to all the teams very equally. So if we have a sponsor, like we have one of our big sponsors is ESPN, obviously, then that sponsorship trickles down 1/12 to each of the 12 teams. So if you look at our business model, it's league sponsorships, local sponsorships, and then our ticket revenue. Mm. This is a very simple business model, mm-hmm. but the viability is very important. When Kelly and I decided to do this, and Kelly was a basketball player through high school,
right.
and she has a very serious day job as well. We looked at it as something we thought was important for young women, and we do. We believe in the mission. But if you believe in the mission of something, whatever it is, you've got to make it viable.
You've got to act on it.
And so we look at this as a business, and we want our players to look at it that way, our coaches, and certainly our business team, because if it doesn't succeed as a business, it's not going to be sustainable over the long haul. And so we all have to do what we can. Like, why is Leisha here today?
Mm-hmm.
Leisha's here today because certainly she feels this commitment to the dream, but anything she can do to get our message out there and to get more people supporting our team, the better off we'll be and the more successful and the stronger we'll be.
Is there a tension between the WNBA and the NBA?
No, there it is.
Okay.
They are so supportive. Adam
okay.
Silver, the commissioner, could not be more supportive. David Stern first decided we should have a league when he was here in 1996. The Olympics were here.
Mm-hmm.
He saw how amazing the college game was
yes.
and thought, gee, could we do something in the off season of the NBA, use those arenas, and have these incredible women play?
Absolutely.
And guess
Absolutely.
What? Next year we had a league that began. So that's what I mean when I say they own our league. The resources that are available to the NBA, we have as resources, whether
well,
it's
so
marketing
how,
or sales.
So why don't you get the media coverage that you should get? I mean, why aren't you? Why isn't Mike and Mike showing highlights, you know, from the WNBA
right.
games as well as the NBA games?
Now we do get some highlights when something really amazing happens. But you know what? We've got to earn that. We've got, you know, we always say we've got to get enough people in our arenas. We've got to get enough buzz. You think about, why do people follow teams? Think about it. What do you read every day about sports? You read about the players. People follow players. They are dedicated to teams. But Leisha, coming to us from Indiana, thrilled us. We knew we needed her.
Right.
Leisha came in and blew us away. I mean, you did. Now, we could say it's because she was a starting, you know, point guard, and, you know, she had an opportunity given to her that she maybe hadn't quite had before. But she came in and just blew the whole team away, blew the coaching staff, blew all of us. It's like, whoa, we were glad to get Leisha, but she was so much better. So we, you know, that really helps, having
well,
buzz about a
but
player.
But in a way, it's a kind of catch-22 because you can't get more coverage on, you know, it's like you don't get enough support because you don't get a whole lot of coverage, but yet you can't get a whole lot of coverage because you don't have a lot of support.
It's the chicken or the egg.
Yeah,
What we can do or what we're doing with you today.
You're listening to Valerie Jackson in Conversation, and I'm your host, Valerie Jackson, talking with Mary Brock, co-owner of the WNBA Atlanta Dream. We'll be back after this short break.
This is Valerie Jackson, back in conversation this evening with Mary Brock, co-owner of the Atlanta WNBA team, The Dream, and Laisha Clarendon, point guard for The Dream. Laisha, I grew up with five brothers out of eight kids, five brothers who all played sports. Even though I played with them, you know, at home, I'd never played on a team, mainly because that was pre-Title IX also. Mm-hmm. I mean, way back, probably even before Mary. But there were no real teams for me to play on. Fast forward now, today, mm-hmm. My youngest daughter, who wanted to play football, was the first girl to play on Lovett's eighth grade football team as a tackle, I might add.
Oh, wow.
And so the world has turned around, you know, and now she didn't follow through on that. She ended up marrying a Pittsburgh Steeler, an NFL player. That was as close as she got to professional football. But I'm just so excited that young women and girls are now having the access that they are getting to sports. And talking about accessibility, the odds aren't real good making a professional team because there are so few draft slots, mm-hmm. one or two rookie slots a year. So what makes you push? What pushes you to be one of those, to get one of those slots?
My dad has definitely been a big influencer all of my life. I talk about him a lot in interviews. Since I was a young kid, he always just instilled in me 110%. So 100 was never good enough. It was 110%. So it was, whether it was school or whether it was basketball or you're going to play volleyball too and run track, like, it's 110%.
Wow.
So we had a half-court slab in our backyard.
Really?
A cement slab with a hoop out there. And he actually put a light up at night, and I just played for hours and hours and hours. And my older sister played, so I kind of, by the time I came into it, I feel like there was never a time I didn't have a basketball in my hand.
Were you ever attracted to any other sport, or just always basketball?
I was. I played volleyball in high school, and I did some track. I didn't really want to run track, but my dad's like, it's good for you, you know, it'll help you in basketball, that, you know, stay in shape,
right,
and that whole thing. So I ran track for a few years. I played volleyball. And then my senior year, you know, kind of being worried about injuries, I didn't play any sport but basketball. I just kind of focused on that.
Mm-hmm.
While the whole time always playing for a travel team, too. So you're kind of playing volleyball, but you're always playing with your travel basketball team still. So I was never too far away from basketball.
What were some of the highlights in college for you playing basketball for UC Berkeley?
It was definitely the historic Final Four run that we went on. Yeah, my senior year. This was really special. And it was cool to see all of that, to get that far, because mm-hmm. that's the reason I stayed on the West Coast, was I didn't want to go to a Tennessee or Connecticut, obviously really great programs. But I saw only Stanford good on the West Coast, and mm-hmm. I was like, I want to help make a team good, and I want to help West Coast basketball be better. So to kind of see that happen and to make history there and to have that vision as such a young person, I mean, only 18, 19, and then to see it coming out of college is really special.
That's fantastic. Talk about the difference between playing in college versus playing for a professional team. In college, you got a lot of visibility and so forth. Talk about the difference, if there is, between playing in college versus in WNBA.
It's very different. So I think even the schemes are different. They're starting to match each other a little more, but you'll see the way that people play ball screens is kind of different. And so it's called icing screens, where you don't let them use it. And definitely what a lot of people say is the speed, the physicality, and even the rules are different. So coming in as a rookie, you have to kind of learn those schemes. You have to learn all of a sudden there's defense at 3 seconds. Like, what is that's not a thing in college. You can stand in the paint all you want.
Right.
And so then the shot clock's only 24 seconds. And like, now in college I was only playing against people 18 to maybe 22, and now I'm playing 22 to people can be 40. So I think there's that bigger gap of being a rookie, you're just a 22-year-old, and now you're playing against, you know, a veteran. When I was at Indiana, Tamika Catchings, who's going into her, 14th year. And so there's that physicality that I noticed the most, and I was a really skinny when I came into the league, only, 135 pounds. So it took me a while to adjust and make sure I put on some muscle and just adjust to all the...
You mentioned a couple of differences between the college versus the professional, the WNBA. Talk a little bit about the difference between NBA rules and WNBA rules, because I have to confess, I'm kind of ignorant on that, and I had to Google it. So I'm going to read what I found on Google and ask you if it's right.
Okay.
Because I don't know if I trust Google or not. Okay. The NBA and the WNBA, have both evolved, obviously, as basketball associations. But the NBA does not allow zone defenses. No zone defenses means that every player must guard another straight up.
So I believe that's the defense of 3 seconds, where you have to be legally guarding a player. So if you're going to stand in the paint, you have to be an arm's length from the player.
Oh.
So that we have that rule as well. That changed my rookie season in 2013. They added the defense of 3 seconds.
It says the WNBA allows any type of defense on the court, which makes the game interesting. Is that,
are they not allowed,
is
like,
that
actual
true?
Zones
that,
in the NBA?
Some of that has changed in the last couple
of years.
Okay,
that's why I don't trust Google.
That was a difference, and that is, they're making it more and more. And as a fan, when you're watching, it's very hard to see that call.
Right.
When that call is made, you think, what?
Right.
But it's the 3 seconds. Is
it true that WNBA players have more picks, more movement, and generally have more team basketball? Is that true?
I think you'd have to look at the team. I'd argue the Spurs are one of the best ball movement teams, and I could argue Seattle Storm was one of the best ball movement teams last year. So I think I don't always believe in those generalities. I think you have to look team by team basis.
It says the NBA uses a 48-minute game and test endurance more than the 40-minute WNBA games. Do you think that 5 minutes really makes a difference? I mean, 8 minutes?
I think it does. I think that's fine. There are things that we like about our game that we think, I mean, certainly they are physical specimens in the NBA, no doubt about it. But I think the fact that we have the 24-second shot clock automatically means we have a faster up and down the court game, whereas if you're watching an NBA game, an NCAA game for the men, you watch and you watch and you watch, and their shot clock is longer, and so nothing happens. So in an NBA game, it seems to me things either happen very quickly, they take the ball and they're down the court and they dunk the ball, or it goes on and on and on and nothing happens, and in the last 5 seconds it happens. Whereas there's more action on a minute by minute basis. You're right, the Spurs, a lot of people say the Spurs play more like basketball used to be played. That's why a lot of people love to watch them, because they're a very interesting and fun team to watch, whereas there are some teams that are all about individuals. I would make the generalization that, and I'm someone who doesn't like generalizations being from the state of Mississippi, but I would say that in general it is played more as a team sport. There's more passing the ball back and forth, and it's 24 seconds, so you have to. But of course, just as Leija said, you can't make generalizations about every team.
Leija, one of the other big differences between WNBA and NBA is obviously the salaries. And a lot of players, especially, women players, go abroad, go to Europe to play ball, out of school. As a matter of fact, who is it? Is it Maya Moore who made $1.5 million from Russia, from a team from Russia offered her 1.5 as opposed to her getting maybe 500,000 here or something, if that much. So what kept you in the U.S.? Why didn't you go abroad? Because you probably could have been snapped up very quickly. So why'd you stay?
I did go my first season.
Oh, you
did? My first season out of my rookie year, I went, and I was exhausted because I played college. I went to the Final Four, and I played 20-something minutes in the summer, and then you leave 10 days after your last game. And so I was over there, kind of had some injuries and just exhausted, kind of like, what am I doing this for? Money's nice, but it's not the only thing that motivates me. And I spoke about those differences earlier, jumping from college to pro and only being 135 pounds. And there were things that I was able to do in the college game that when I got to the pro, I'd like drive and get blocked from the back or the side. And I'm like, these girls are huge. Like, this isn't, I was able to do these things in college. And so for me, it was committing to myself and taking the pay cut because I wasn't where I wanted to be in this league. And this was the most important to me, to, play in front of my friends and family, to live in the U.S. And so it was a huge sacrifice that I took and had to really take a gut check to be like, hey, like, you know, you're leaving six figures on the table. But I think, hadn't I done that, when I got traded to Atlanta, I wouldn't have been ready to step up, because I took 2 years off to work on my ball screens, to gain the muscle that I needed to do to take the rest. And so it's really paid off.
Well, do you think that the WNBA requirement that you be 22 years old before playing professional basketball is a good thing?
I do think it is. I think it's interesting that we're seeing a lot more women come out earlier than we ever have. I think we saw two women come out in this draft from South Carolina. I think the women, we don't have the opportunity to make the same money as the men. And so I do think putting that focus on education is important. And so I think that rule that they can still come out at 22, I think is reasonable.
Because historically, what we said, and Kelly and I, when we joined the ownership group of the Dream, at that time, people weren't coming out early.
Right.
So we essentially said, all of our team were college graduates. And that's a good thing to be able to say. That's a big, talk about a difference than the WNBA and the NBA.
Right.
That's the big difference. Because, I mean, we can say, I think, safely, women are generally socially and emotionally mature earlier than men anyway. So you take these, you know, these young men who are very talented and put them in the NBA with these huge salaries.
Yeah.
It's really tough, and we've seen it happen. So we've always been able to say that. More and more women are going to, because you either have to be a college graduate or 4 years past graduation, 22, and we have seen more. But for that extra year of, you know, the beginning rookie salary that you make, and then, of course, you have the earlier opportunity to go off and make six figures. So that's once. That happens once. You do it after your junior year rather than your senior year. What are you giving up? You're giving up that college degree that when you're 22 is really going to matter. So even if you do the math,
right,
I do not think it's worth it. So we truly wish that it was done less, and we hope it won't continue to be done more.
Do women have the same pressure to perform well in sports over academics? You know, some schools, they lift those boys up whether they've got the grades or not, and they somehow or another manage to play. Is that same pressure on girls?
To not necessarily have the GPA?
That, you know, they kind of say, well, don't worry about the GPA, because you've got a great GPA. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're wonderful, over 3.5 or something like that. But but for those who are struggling, is the emphasis more on, well, just hang in there till you can get this game done, or is it you need to go and take care of your schoolwork? I mean, do you see a difference between the men and the women, I guess I'm saying, in terms of the focus on performance versus academics?
Having gone through college athletics, I think all too often the focus is on sports. And at the end of the day, I think there's so much pressure on coaches to keep their jobs, right, and universities to perform. I do think that we say student-athlete, but so many times it becomes the athlete-student, right, even your scheduling. And I think at the end of the day, trying to keep your athletes eligible matters. But I think, I can't speak to the men and women thing, but having gone through it, I know that there is, we need to continue to focus back on the student. But sports and performance, a lot of times I've seen, comes first.
And, you know, I'm very involved also at Georgia Tech. So one of the things, I don't know if you mentioned, but I have an endowed scholarship for basketball at Georgia Tech. It's very important to me, and that's just a school that John and I support quite a bit. And there, and it's a tough school. Berkeley's a tough school. And so clearly, I mean, you do have to graduate, generally, historically. WNBA players have had to graduate. And it's tough. I mean, you're playing sports. It's almost a full-time job. So you're in school. You really need extra help. You really need, you know, tutors and everything else. But on the other hand, winning is very important, too. I know a few years ago, one of the proudest moments of Michelle Joseph, who's the coach of the Georgia Tech team, is she presented the diplomas of four of her seniors at graduation. And that's big. That's big time. And they graduated. There's not, I mean, you can't graduate from Georgia Tech without taking a calculus course and a lab science and a computer science course. You've got to take them and you've got to pass them. There's not an easy major. So I don't care what your major is. So, you know, it's that juxtaposition of keeping your job, producing winning teams, and yet having young women who go out into the world and can do something. It's tough.
We'll be back right after this short break and continue our conversation with Mary Brock, co-owner of the Atlanta WNBA team, The Dream, and Laysha Clarendon, the Atlanta Dream's starting point guard on the court and an outspoken LGBT rights advocate off the court. Welcome back to Valerie Jackson in Conversation. I'm your host, Valerie Jackson, and joining me in the studio is the WNBA Atlanta Dream co-owner, Mary Brock, and starting point guard for the team, Laysha Clarendon. Laysha, you were named the Outsports Female Hero of 2015. I understand that you also identify as, quote, black, gay, female, non-cisgender, and Christian, end quote. Why is it important to you to state these terms in terms of identifying yourself publicly? Mm-hmm. Or is it important to you to
it
state
It has been
them?
Very important, having, you know, even gone to Berkeley and just kind of found my consciousness and my identity and kind of who I am. And it was really a time where I was figuring out my sexuality and kind of finding God. And so through a lot of that, I think it's important because we see a lot of people, especially in this country, that are looking for places to fit in. Mm-hmm. And so for me, it's making sure people know, like, hey, you can be gay and Christian, or, you know, I am a proud black woman, and I am gender nonconforming is what that means. I don't always dress traditionally how women dress. And so I think it's important to be a role model in that and to identify that. So I think younger people can see that, like, it is okay. It doesn't matter what you are, that I want to help people celebrate that diversity instead of kind of trying to push us all to fit into a certain box.
Now, you're very outspoken about the LGBTQ community, but you said really that you kind of got more pushback when you talked about women's issues than when you talk about LGBTQ. Why do you think that is?
It's shocking. Well, I think we have to remember that a lot of it's rooted in sexism. And so it's crazy because the article that you're referencing is what I talked about how much I didn't get pushback. And then when that article came out, I got a lot of pushback. So it was really funny that when I started talking about women's issues, I just got trolled, like, on Twitter, the most I've ever got trolled. Like, people just commenting, I mean, like, threats and just really negative things that I had to kind of block and report spam.
What was the problem with commenting on women's issues? Is there a reason why you shouldn't have? I don't understand why anybody would.
I think it's a lot of the sexism that people, they...
Oh, just the fact that you were talking about sexism, period.
Yeah, I think a lot of guys still kind of just like, we're in that equal opportunity. Women can be CEOs. Women have opportunities where they don't still see that, like, oh, there's still a pay gap with gender, or there's still a pay gap when you add race into it, or there's still these opportunities where I wake up and work just as hard as Steph Curry or Kawhi Leonard or Maya Moore does and Diana Taurasi, but they don't get paid, you know, a tenth of that. So I think it's kind of getting people to even understand this. And they're kind of complex issues, right? They're like a complex sociology class that not everyone's taken. And so talking about these issues, you can see people that kind of really focus on simple things. And I'm trying to get them to understand the bigger systematic issues and how ingrained sexism is in our society. And so it was really kind of comical and ironic that that was the time that I got the most pushback.
Exactly.
There are several words you use to describe yourself, including non-cisgender and Christian. First of all, I only found out what cisgender was a few weeks ago, so I'm still learning. And I wonder if there are so many different terms out there now. Are we getting confusing? Because, you know, first it was just L, LBG, you know, lesbian, bisexual. And then it's LBGQ, and then there's LBGQT, and now there's cisgender, and then there are we confusing the situation with so many words? Do we need to kind of simplify it back to just people, period, as opposed to adjectives?
I think we could, right? Yeah. I think that's the thing with race. People want to say, like, aren't we all just humans?
Yeah.
And I wish we could all just show up and be ourselves every day, right? Like, I can't choose when I'm black or not black. So I think in an ideal world, we all show up and we don't have to worry about, you know, what my name might look on a resume versus Mary's name. Mm-hmm. Or when I walk in a room, how I'm perceived versus a different person or my gender. Mm-hmm. And so I think in an ideal world, we could all just be humans. But I think that language is important. And I think a lot of the terms are evolving and they're giving people a way to identify and a way to be seen. And I think that's really important. And mm-hmm. I think that's helps people be healthy. And so I think it's something that mm-hmm. I get that question kind of a lot. And sometimes it comes from the generations before, like even my dad, like, what does this mean now? And I'm like, don't fight it, Dad, you know, try and embrace it. And I know it's hard and I'm not trans. And so that was one issue for me that I was like, ooh, I don't want to say the wrong thing, you know, like,
because you're not trans, you didn't want to offend any
transgender.
Yeah,
like you can tell when you're not a part of a group that you don't want to say the wrong thing or say, I don't want to say, you know, F to M, which is like male to female. Or, you know, I can see how hard it is when you don't understand all the language. Like I have empathy for that. So a lot of times being a part of these communities, I've found that people are really willing to be forgiving. And so it's your intentions that people read, like if you mislabel someone, mm-hmm. right? Or like sometimes people are like, hey, sir, and then I kind of laugh or I'm like, and they're like, oh, sorry. And I'm like, I have really short hair. You know, you saw me from the side. It's okay. And so I think we shouldn't fight that language, that we should embrace it and that people are willing to meet you where you are if you don't always understand all the terms.
What should one do when you misidentify someone? Mm-hmm. Like you just said, someone might have thought that you were, you know, called you sir, but so what does one, because I've been guilty of that.
Yeah.
I've called someone sir or mm-hmm. ma'am when they were not.
Right.
What should I do or what should someone do if they make that mistake? Just ignore it, let it pass? What, I mean,
I think apologize, you know, sometimes if it's at the store or someone's like, oh, sorry. And I'm like, it's okay. You know, and I see their, it's kind of awkward when they don't say anything. I'm like, well, now you know I'm a girl. So are you going to, and when you're talking about trans people, I think is honoring their pronouns. So, right. If you saw someone who says like, I am a trans man and now maybe their license doesn't say that, or you're working with them and you keep calling them a her or a girl. Like when someone tells you how they identify or what their name is, I think it's honoring that. And that's the biggest way is, and if you don't know us, say you're at work with someone and they're really androgynous, you just say like, hey, how do you identify? And ask them that question. And that's okay, having more open dialogue so you don't misgender or misidentify people.
In an NBC News article, Laisha, you said, quote, a lot of who I am and my identity and being so out is wrapped up in my faith and my belief in God. Now, there are a lot of people who use religion and God to denigrate the gay community. Mm-hmm. How do you resolve that difference? Well, because there appears to be a kind of...
There's a tension there for sure. Mm-hmm. And so that story goes back to college, right? I didn't really grow up Christian. So having gone to college, like my family kind of was, but we didn't really, you know, we went to church on Easter. I had to wear a dress. I hated it. And so I didn't really have a relationship with God or really identify with any part of religion. And so going to college, one of my teammates invited me to church and I like loved it and like fell in love with God. And then but I knew who I was. So I knew that these two things didn't always go together. And so I read a ton and it was a really tough time for me in my first 2 years. And I had a really good coach who we think these people are mentors, right? And so I'm always really thankful for that coach I had, Joanne Boyle, who was a straight Christian woman. And I would just like go in her office and cry, right? And say like, my dad doesn't accept me. I couldn't be out to my family. The team was accepting, but I kind of knew that it just wasn't okay. And so she was someone who was really there for me. And through like a lot of reading and even talking to my pastor, thankfully, the first church I walked into college was an accepting one, and it wasn't mm-hmm. one where they told
accepting
me.
Accepting of gays, blacks, whomever.
Right, mm-hmm. It wasn't, oh, you can't be this, and so I didn't have a bad experience with religion. I had a really positive experience with church, and they're really accepting and welcoming, and where I know a lot of people don't have that. And so for me, it was talking to my pastor, having a good mentor in my life, and reading a lot, and I honestly just started praying for like the last like year. It was like, can you just give me peace? Like, if I'm okay, if this is who I'm meant to be, like, can I just have peace? Like, I don't want to carry it anymore. I don't want to cry. I don't want to not know. Like, just let me feel okay. And so kind of going into my junior and senior year, I feel like I finally found that, you know, that peace that surpasses all understanding. That was just like, no one can tell me that I'm not okay and this is not who I'm meant to be.
And that a Christian can't be gay.
Exactly. Mm.
Yeah.
Don't ask me a question now. I'm like, I'm all choked up. You see why we're so proud of her.
I do. So how has it been here in Atlanta versus California? Have you found a place of prayer here in Atlanta? Have you found that the LGBTQ community here is aligned with you spiritually and otherwise?
I have. We don't have a lot of Sundays off, so it's always been really difficult in season to go to a church. And obviously, I got traded last year, like a week before the season started. So I kind of had to talk to people and try and find some community. So I went to a church a couple times out here. When I was in Indiana, like Tamika Catchings, we would kind of host a Bible study on the road and invite people on the team. So I'm thinking about trying to do something like that more this season. I know like Elizabeth William and some other players might want to be involved in that. And obviously coming to Atlanta is so diverse and so open and welcoming. Yes. And so it's a little different than being at Indiana, but I was actually surprised to find a place out there that was also LGBT affirming. So I think there are places across the country, obviously it's not the norm, but I think there are small pockets in different places where people are doing this work and they are accepting.
I was so impressed when I was reading, researching you. And I told Mary before the interview started, I said, I have fallen in love with Lacia because you were just so impressive. Not only were you a good student and a good player, but you went out of your way to help young people. I read somewhere where you helped, where you took assignments to disadvantaged students, to handicapped students or something. Mm-hmm. You would take them. Tell me about that. What were you doing there?
I was just at Cal. I actually made some really good friends that happened to be disabled students. So just being involved with the disability program and helping them kind of navigate campus.
Oh, well, but see, a lot of people, with everything else that you're doing, the basketball, mm-hmm. the practice, the grades, that you still found time, you know, to reach out into your community as a Christian. That's wonderful. Mary. I'm going to do a little quick switch up here because I wanted to hit on this because we talked about sports and leadership, the nexus of sports and leadership. Mm-hmm. But there's also another nexus of sports and the arts, which mm-hmm. is, I think about when I think about you working with Usher, you know, and, mm-hmm. and music and that type of thing. How did you get involved with Usher's foundation and what does the foundation do?
Usher New Look is an incredible organization, and it's his dream child from when his mother, you could say his mother's dream child, from when he was successful at such a young age. And she took him to court, this is a true story, and had him look at all the people who were sitting there who had been charged with something and who didn't have anyone there to support them and all the trouble that they could get into. And she said, and look at you, look how blessed you are. And look at the support group you have, your mother, your aunts, and others at this young age. And you just need to always know that wherever you are in your life and in your career, you're better off than someone. And, you know, Leija's saying that she was in college and had a very busy life, but, you know, you're always better off and have more time than someone. And I think that's what it is. And his whole philosophy is peer-to-peer mentoring, having your peers mentor you, finding what your spark is mm-hmm. when you're in the eighth grade, going on and finishing high school, doing something post-secondary. And then the fourth pillar of Usher New Look is giving back. Mm-hmm. And I think that's, you know, it's
The kids come and give back.
The kids come, right. The kids who have been through the program mm-hmm. come and give back. Right. And I really think that's kind of a life skill. If we could teach that to everyone,
yeah.
I mean, I think Leija is going to clearly do something like that because, you know, those yeah. of us who are blessed and, you know, John and I grew up in a small yeah. town in Mississippi and my gosh, we certainly, you know, had no idea where life would take us and life has taken us in some very good ways, but we always know that we're here by the grace of God.
Absolutely.
That, you know, John has certainly worked very hard in his career and he has been successful, but life can take many turns and twists. And if you start giving yourself all the credit, You know, do you think, Leisure works hard. Yeah. She perfects her art. But she knows she was born with some talents.
Yes.
And then she was blessed to have a dad who really inspired her. And she's obviously been blessed to have people who are accepting of her. And I think the thing that I was the most intrigued about with Leisure is I read about her, because I read about her too. Because she's, you know, obviously, our players are at the forefront of who we are. So we love to know what they're all about. And I think one of the most confusing things for a lot of people was the term that it is a confusing term to us, mm-hmm. and that's Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
That's not a confusing term. The confusing thing to some people was how she could have these other labels, mm-hmm. self-identified
right.
labels, that were in there with Christianity. And I think the reason we have to use those, and I've certainly learned a lot in my work at Spelman, mm-hmm. And many other things too. But if we don't, if those words don't start naturally falling off of our lips and out of our mouths, then they're never going to become words that we're comfortable with. And we have to say them and use them. And the more we do, the more we, understand them. And,
right.
That's very, very important too.
As we wrap up, Leisure, can you tell me what advice you would have for young women who want to play sports on college teams and get a college education too?
Oh, that's a good one. I'd have to, go back to my dad's lessons again, and it's still something I carry on, and I tell college teams, I was just at LMU before I came out here, is that you have to do the little things when no one's watching, and it's the 110% every day that you give.
Mm.
And so it's not Monday I show up, I feel really good, right? I can work hard, everyone's there on Monday. What are you like on Thursday and Friday?
When they're not there.
Even Saturday. Mm-hmm. Yeah, when you're tired, right? We've had camp for the last 3 or 4 days. So the first day, everyone's all excited for camp. And the second day you come back, like, I'm a little sore now. I might have rolled my ankle. I'm tired. We're getting up at 5:45 a.m. And so it's the consistency that makes people great. And it's how you do it every day and in and out. And so my, philosophy every day is be great in everything that I do. Well, it's like, I'm going to the grocery store, I'm going to be great in my shopping list. It's everything, and it's a mentality that, I'm going to do it all every single day and give my best.
What do you see you doing after basketball? Because, you're going to always continue to climb and grow. And so what interest do you have beyond sports?
I think public speaking. That's one I've been really involved with as my kind of brand has evolved. And then broadcasting. I started broadcasting last offseason.
Broadcasting what? How?
Broadcasting basketball as an analyst.
Oh, really?
So for the Pac-12 Network, yes.
Oh, really?
So I did 7 games last year for the Pac-12 Network and some in Washington, USC. I didn't get any Cal games, but I did that. It was awesome.
Is that easy to do? To games like that. I mean,
there were some challenges. Like the opening is really different. They're filming you kind of on the court, and so we've done a lot of interviews, but it's different. And there's the big lights are on, and you have to kind of even remembering when to turn and look at the camera and the angles.
Yeah,
so they kept
yeah.
telling me it's a right. 3-way conversation. I can't just talk to Mary. I have to mm-hmm. open up to the audience. So I
right.
was learning that, and there's a guy in your ear telling you all these things.
Tell me about
the
it.
Producer. So that was different for me, but the talking about basketball was easy because I play that every day. And so that's when the game time started and I, all
Boom.
My jitters were gone and
yeah.
it was just fun.
Yeah. So Mary, Dream has played 4 or 5 times in playoffs and at least two championship games, right?
Three.
Go ahead.
We've played 3. We've lost 3.
Okay.
That's what we want to change.
So what are the goals? What are the goals?
Our ultimate goal is to win a championship. It's what we're all working for, right?
Mm-hmm. Do you see that happening?
I do see that happening.
Or
I think with our team, we're a true team. We certainly have our players that. Are more well-known. Certainly have some players who you could say have a little more star power. But we play and win our best games and win our most games when we play as a team. And I think Leisure would completely back me up there. It's just there in front of you in the statistics. When do we win most of our games? When we play as a team.
Mm.
And I think that's what our coach really wants the team to do.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's looking for everybody as Leisure said to work hard in those times when no one is watching. And that is such a good thing to say about life, because what are you doing when you're not, you're not out there in the front of everyone?
Right. Mm-hmm.
What are you doing in your off time? I mean, I know a lot of
right.
people say about my husband, you know, oh, well, once you get to be a CEO, then wow, you've made it. No, you work harder than you've ever worked
right,
in your life.
Right.
Nobody worked harder than John. And I think it's that way in sports. I think it's that way in business. I think it's that
it's way
in
politics.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think that's what, you know, I think that's what we have to do. And yeah. I think we do. And why do we want to do that? Chicken or the egg? We win a championship, we get more engagement.
Absolutely.
We,
absolutely.
You know, get more people watching us. I mean, personally, that's why I thought for women's basketball, it was really a great thing to watch Mississippi State play UConn and win that game.
Yeah.
I mean, that was amazing. It's like they knew what they needed to do on that given night, and they did it all. Mm-hmm. And that's good for women's basketball. That's the college level. What's good for, it's good for our professional league to have players who excel and do things that are remarkable.
Well, so, we've talked about how to get more people out to the games, and my daughter is a fan, and she's been to several games. And I think the key is, in my reading, I glean that people, all they really need is to see one live game. You know, if they see one live game, they'll start watching it on TV. It's that live game that seems to
capture
everybody.
Watch it on your
everybody.
Phone. You know, get the WNBA app. Mm-hmm. You can watch it on a Delta flight, you know, absolutely. But certainly our first game, May 21st, 3 in the afternoon on a Sunday, we are hoping to pack McCamish Pavilion. We're playing at Georgia Tech this year, which is an incredible facility. Mm-hmm. State-of-the-art theater lighting. So we're hoping on May 21st to have everyone there.
Well, I have certainly enjoyed this conversation, ladies.
Thank you
so much for being with me today.
We have to. Thank you.
That's it. Until next time, this is Valerie Jackson, reminding you that I've got the best conversations in town. Thanks for joining us this evening. You can listen to this and other episodes of Valerie Jackson in Conversation by visiting our website at wabe.org/inconversation. This series is a production of WABE FM 90.1 and Public Broadcasting Atlanta. The producer for the show is Marjorie Greenbaum. The technical producer and editor is Mike Johns. Programming support by Christine Dempsey, Lois Reitzes, and Dave Baraswain. Until next time, this is Valerie Jackson in Conversation. Thanks for listening.